of Rafah in southern Gaza, saying offensive will be absolutely catastrophic. In a letter to the UN chief, Iran urges the world body to stop the Israeli massacre of Palestinians in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. And the Yemeni army says it shot down a U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drone over the Red Sea after hitting two American ships with naval missiles. Our top story, Israel continues carrying on with its genocidal campaign in Gaza as a death toll on the territory tops 29,000, most of them women and children. Israeli strikes target the Nusayrat refugee camp, killing several civilians. Regime warplanes also bombed other neighborhoods throughout the territory. The Indonesian and Al Amal hospitals were also targeted as the regime continues its unrelenting onslaught on Gaza's health sector. The Palestinian Red Crescent says the situation inside Al Amal Hospital is highly dangerous after 28 days of continued siege imposed on it by the Israeli army. It said the Israeli forces targeted and damaged a water desalination station at the hospital, warning the available drinking water is only sufficient for 3 days.
Israeli regime is still committing atrocities against the besieged Gaza Strip with American-made weapons. Endless number of bombs has been raining on the Strip for more than 4 successive months, with Gaza's health sector admitting a tremendous number of the Palestinian casualties. One should take into account the Gaza medical infrastructure, which is devastated due to 17 years of siege and also the systematic Israeli attacks. That besides the delayed permissions issued for the injured Palestinians in need of traveling outside Gaza Strip has exacerbated the already catastrophic conditions.
We fled our house in Al Buraiji camp to Deir al-Balah 40 days ago. We were targeted in the house for no reason. Many members of the family got killed over the attack. My father was among those injured. As you can see, he has severe burns all over his body. We're still waiting for the permission to travel abroad to get the needed medical care. We appeal to whoever is able to help us get permission for my father to travel. His condition is critical, and I don't want to lose him.
According to Gaza's health ministry, hundreds of injured Palestinians, including men, women, and children, lost their lives due to that delay, while thousands are facing imminent death due to serious wounds they sustained in Israeli attacks. Even those who managed to survive have one or more of their limbs amputated.
The number of the injured Palestinians is 4 times the capacity of hospitals, and this number is dramatically increasing over the constant Israeli airstrikes. We have at least 11,000 people injured in the Gaza Strip. Only in this hospital, 2,100 need an urgent permission to travel. The main obstacle is that receiving the approval for any case could take days or weeks. As a result, many might lose their life while waiting for the permission. We demand all relevant parties to set more effective mechanisms that help to rescue the people here.
It's noteworthy that the problem also includes the Palestinian patients with the chronic diseases and those in need of urgent surgeries.
I am Dr. Khaled Al-Saidni, working at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital since 2001. At the start of this aggression, I felt pain in my right leg. I found that my arteries were 80% blocked. Knowing that I'm a diabetic patient, my fellows told me that I needed an urgent permission to travel abroad to undergo a surgery before my health deteriorated and had my leg amputated. I have contacted and appealed all relevant parties to hasten the permission because time is really decisive. And as you can see, I have been waiting for the permission for about 2 months with no response.
Having a brush with the people inside any health facility in Gaza Strip is enough to wrench your heart when you see the injured children and their parents imploring for travel permission. Now the question for the Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip remains unanswered: that Who bears the responsibility for this delay that threatens the life of many injured Palestinians in Gaza Strip? The central area of Gaza Strip.
A member of the Islamic Jihad movement has hailed what he calls unprecedented losses inflicted on the Israelis by Palestinian resistance movements.
Despite its limited military equipment, the Palestinian resistance has inflicted heavy losses on the Israeli enemy, part of which the regime has admitted. The Israeli regime struggles to underreport its losses in order to keep the soldiers and settlers spread up. The more Israeli assaults against the Palestinian nation and the Gaza Strip, the more losses the regime will suffer.
An exclusive interview with Press TV, Ali Abu Shahi said the Israeli regime is not able to hide the casualties it suffered in Gaza. Member of the Political Bureau of Islamic Jihad rejected Israeli allegations that resistance factions are using hospitals as operation headquarters. He said the regime levels such allegations to justify bombing mosques and health centers. Ali Abu Shahi said the fact the regime forces invade these hospitals and have found no resistance fighters reveals the Palestinian movements are not using civilian infrastructure for military operations. Meanwhile, the chorus of warnings is growing louder every day against an Israeli ground incursion into the refugee-packed city of Rafah in southern Gaza. In a joint statement, the EU foreign minister said offensive will worsen already catastrophic humanitarian situation. They said it will also prevent provisions of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian aid. Ministers called for an immediate humanitarian pause that will lead to a lasting ceasefire. Hungary, a close ally of Tel Aviv, was the sole country that did not sign up. The EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, said the invasion of Rafah is a violation of humanitarian law, while the Irish foreign minister called it unconscionable. Some 1.5 million refugees are crammed into Rafah, and this is after being repeatedly displaced by the Israeli onslaught. Iran's foreign minister has called on the United Nations to act swiftly and resolutely and stop Israel massacring Palestinians in Gaza. In a letter to the UN chief, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Israeli crimes in Gaza cannot be described as anything but genocide. He warned any Israeli ground invasion of the densely populated city of Rafah will be another phase in that genocide. The top Iranian diplomat added, vast trail of death and destruction in Gaza is testament to premeditated Israeli plot to exterminate a whole nation. Amir Abdullahian said Israel is also depriving Palestinians of food, water, humanitarian aid, and other essential resources to make Gaza unlivable and force Palestinians off their territory. The occupied West Bank Israeli forces have intensified raids and illegal detention of Palestinians. Mona Candiel has your details.
The Israeli military raids to Palestinian areas had become common. Every day, the Israeli forces storm Palestinian villages, towns, cities, all across the occupied West Bank. The Israeli justification or excuse is always the same: to detain Palestinians, members of the resistance groups, Palestinian fighters, Palestinian activists, anyone who's against the Israeli military and the Israeli regime. This morning, the Israeli forces had arrested 25 Palestinians during military raids to the town of Kober, north Ramallah. The Israelis had also raided Al-Masayif near Ramallah, Kufr Qaddoum in Qalqilia, Aqbat Jabr in Ariha, this refugee camp south Ariha. And the Israelis had also stormed the village of Qabatia, south Jenin, and they remained there for over 5 hours. During these 5 hours, 40 Palestinians had been detained from the town of Qabatia, and they were interrogated and questioned inside the village of Qabatia. Of course, we are speaking about interrogation, about difficult situation, about the storming Palestinian homes early on Monday and at the night hours. After the interrogation, the majority of those 40 were released. However, a number of them had been detained and taken by the Israeli forces in order to be held in Israeli jails. The Israelis had detained over 7,100 Palestinians since the 7th of October, according to Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs.
The Yemeni army released a video footage showing debris of a U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drone that it shot down. Footage also shows the moment the drone was hit off the coast of Yemen and pieces being pulled out of the sea. Two U.S. officials have confirmed that an Air Force Reaper drone was shot down in the Red Sea. This is the second time since November that Yemeni forces have taken out a Reaper drone. On Monday, Yemeni forces also targeted two U.S. ships and a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. Yemeni army spokesman said the British vessel later sank. Yahya Sadi stressed army will continue to target U.S. and U.K. vessels in response to attacks by the two countries against Yemen and in solidarity with Palestinians.
In yet another operation against Western interests in support of Palestinian in war-torn Gaza, the spokesman for the Yemeni army announced the successful targeting of the British vessel Roby Mar in the Gulf of Aden with naval missiles. The reprisal operation resulted in damage and complete cessation of its functioning.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces, with the help of God, carried out a military operation targeting a British ship in the Gulf of Aden, Roby Mar, with a number of appropriate naval missiles. The results of the operation were the following. The ship was seriously damaged, causing it to stop completely. As a result of the extensive damage the ship suffered, it is now at risk of sinking in the Gulf of Aden. During the operation, we made sure that the ship's crew exited safely.
The Yemeni army also shut down an American MQ-9 drone in Hodeidah while it was engaged in hostile actions against the Arab country. Experts interpret this operation as a message to the U.S. and the U.K. that Yemeni naval operations will continue until Israel ends its genocidal war in Gaza.
The military operations carried out by the Yemeni naval forces and their targeting of American ships and drones will not stop unless the aggression against our brothers in Gaza stops. This is a new victory for the Yemeni army. Indeed, we are not strong in the face of the world, but we trust that God is the one who supports us.
Yemenis have asserted that the retaliatory operations will not end as long as the Gaza war and all-out U.S. support for Israelis continue. Since the start of the Israeli military campaign against the Gaza Strip, the Yemeni army has conducted naval operations against Israeli-bound vessels in solidarity with the Palestinians. They have also launched numerous ballistic missiles against the occupied territories of Palestine.
Observers say the American designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group has not succeeded in halting the Yemeni army's naval operations. They believe that the U.S. and the U.K. will eventually come to realize that halting the Israeli genocide in Gaza is the only way to protect their interests in the volatile region.
The top UN court at The Hague's opened public hearings on legal consequences of Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. Addressing the tribunal, Palestine's envoy to the UN said the international law has never protected Palestinians.
Israeli leaders no longer feel the need to hide their intentions. They speak openly of getting rid of the Palestinian people one way or another. They defy the law, and the law is barely fighting back. For Palestine, the law continues to be only a measure of the severity of breaches, rather than a catalyst for action and accountability. What does international law mean for Palestinian children in Gaza today? It has protected neither them nor their childhood. It has not protected their families or communities. It has not protected their lives or limbs, their hopes or homes.
Mansour said the Palestinians have faced attempts to push them off their territories for 75 years. He demanded Palestine's occupation come to an immediate and unconditional end. Meanwhile, the legal representative of the State of Palestine focused on the consequences of Israel's numerous violations of international law.
For almost 57 years, despite the repeated appeals of the General Assembly and the Security Council of the UN, and numerous other international organizations, be they NGOs or governmental, Israel has obstinately stuck to its policy of oppression and discrimination against the Palestinian people in breach of the most fundamental principles of international law, and by its practices has continually exacerbated the situation with the unconcealed objective of making impossible the realization of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination.
Over 50 states, including Iran, will participate in the oral proceedings before the International Court of Justice. At the request of the UN General Assembly, the ICJ will then issue a non-binding advisory opinion on Israeli occupation. Last month, the court issued a provisional rule in a case brought by South Africa against Israel. It called on Israel to cease all activities that could constitute genocide in Gaza. However, according to the UN, Israel appears to be in breach of that order. The Brazilian president has called back his ambassador to Tel Aviv for consultations. This following the Israeli regime's protests over the president's remarks strongly condemning Israeli crimes in Gaza. Tensions between Israel and Brazil have escalated since President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva compared Israel's genocide in Gaza to Adolf Hitler's Holocaust. President da Silva also said what's going on in Gaza is a war between a highly trained and prepared army and women and children. He made those statements last week during an African Union summit in Ethiopia. Israel condemned Lula's remarks as anti-Semitic and summoned Brazil's ambassador. Israel's also declared da Silva as persona non grata, saying he's no longer welcome in Israel until he takes back his words. Brazil's among countries that endorsed the case of genocide brought against Israel at the ICJ. That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
With no safe place to turn to, some Palestinians have returned to their destroyed homes, while others have sought refuge in farms. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East I wrote, finding shelter in the Gaza Strip, whether in a basic tent, on the street, or in an overcrowded classroom, has become a luxury for hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians. The Zionist regime's offensive has rendered Gaza almost uninhabitable in just 4 months. The Israeli regime army has destroyed or damaged more than half of the buildings in Gaza and continues to steadily shrink safe or livable spaces across the besieged enclave. It also forced Palestinians out of their homes in northern and central Gaza towards the south, displacing 85% of Gaza's 2.3 million residents. Around 1.5 million people have sought refuge in Rafah, an area spanning just 64 square kilometers, and are now struggling to find enough space to even put up a tent due to extreme overcrowding. The Zionist regime has recently set its sights on Rafah, the last refuge available for Palestinians, escalating its attacks on Gaza's southernmost city and threatening an imminent ground invasion. Under the threat of more mass destruction and death, and pushed by a lack of options, many displaced families across Gaza have been forced to take extreme measures to find shelter. Middle East Eye spoke to one of the five families who sought refuge in a farm in Rafah, where they have turned open chicken cages into beds for their children. Rafat Lukman, whose family of 32 includes newborns and small children, said, "We decided to come to this farm because we could not find any other place to go. We came here thinking that we can put up with it for a few days, but this war has taken much longer. I cannot believe that my own children are sleeping in cages where chickens slept. I look at them, and my heart breaks for the childhood I am giving them. But what else could I do?" From inside the chicken cages, the children can easily spot the Egyptian-controlled Rafah border with its high walls covered with barbed wires. Lukman said, "My daughter took her teddy bear with her when we evacuated the first time. She'd kept it with her the whole time. But the other day, it rained and the farm flooded. She was sleeping in the cage and her teddy fell into the rainwater and got lost. She cried so much about it the next day. And again, her mom and I felt so helpless. We can't even get her a new teddy bear." Lukman's children say they have become used to their new reality now, and it is difficult to remember that one day they had a house and bedrooms. He said, "We are still lucky that we are not dead and that our parents are alive." Rafat's 12-year-old daughter, Mai, said, "But to be honest, I still feel scared of sleeping in cages. They are very cold and dark at night. I have always hated insects, but they are everywhere here, and I cannot do anything about it." In central Gaza, meanwhile, displaced people have also been living in squalid conditions due to overcrowding in shelters, which include schools, hospitals and mosques, and lack of basic services, including clean water, sanitation and a working sewage system. Abu Ahmad Jaber, a father and grandfather, had been sheltering in a UN-run school and decided to go back to his house that was bombed one afternoon while the family was home having lunch. Jaber told Middle East Eye, "The situation in the schools is horrible. They are overcrowded. No toilets, no food, no water, no privacy whatsoever. So I decided to come back with my family to my bombed house and live in whatever space was left standing." When the Zionist regime bombed his house, smoke engulfed the family, blackening the afternoon light. Jaber said, "We thought we were dead." Thank you. The elderly man and his sons pulled out their pregnant sister and her one-year-old daughter from under the rubble with their bare hands. The family fled to school for shelter, where his daughter bled for hours before an ambulance was able to make its way to them. Despite their traumatic experience, Jaber, who suffers from heart problems and diabetes, made the decision to return to their destroyed home in Boraj, in central Gaza, because he felt that all other alternatives lacked dignity. He said, "This is my house. How can I let go of it? I literally built it with my hands, stone by stone. I look at it 20 times a day, and I struggle with the fact that I cannot even rebuild or fix anything." He said, in a voice full of sorrow and anger, "I cry every night. I cannot even sleep anymore. If I fall asleep and wake up for any reason, I cannot fall back asleep. I'm living a very primitive life amid the rubble, but I would rather do that, leave my house and evacuate from one place to another like chess pieces. And what for? What have I and my family done? I have realized that no one cares because we are in Gaza. We have turned into videos for people to watch. Why is it so hard to give us our very basic rights that are granted to us by all international laws? I cannot understand the world." The displacement of almost 2 million people in Gaza have brought back memories of the Nakba, or catastrophe, in 1948, when 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their homes by Zionist militias to make way for the newly created regime of Israel. Palestinians in Gaza are living today what their grandparents lived over 70 years ago, and the fear of never being able to return is at the heart of their concern. Jaber said, "If the house is destroyed, the land is still there, and it is mine. I would rather die here than live another Nakba like my family did before me. I'm not asking for help to leave or evacuate. I am asking for an end to this war and help in rebuilding my house and rebuilding Gaza. All I really want is peace. I want to see my children get married, have jobs, and look forward to their future with their own children."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, The Viewpoints. Here in the studio, I am with Brother Ali and Sheikh Agha Mohammadi, Islamic scholars and researchers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, brother. Thanks for inviting me to this show.
There are people in the society that they see that it's impossible to have worldly ideals along with religion. They say that there are two things separated. And the people who support this idea, or some people who disagree. So, you know, some people find it difficult to balance between these two. I mean, sometimes they, go fast. Sometimes they, it's so hard to find the balance, to have a balance between these two extremes I mentioned. How? And can believers find this balance finally?
In the practice,
Yeah, that's a fact, that it's not easy. So to do that, people first, they have to learn, they have to be trained. Sometimes, unfortunately, we see that the religion and Islam, we're talking specifically about Islam, it is limited to some rituals, to some rulings of fiqh, while the greater side of it is the lifestyle, that is, to a large extent, is ignored. So we need a pure society. A pure society is to pave the way for the believers to have a good lifestyle and to have a good social and individual life according to the teachings of Islam. Then you will see that it can happen and it's not something impossible. Even to study the life that they have. I mean, sometimes they say that why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran refers to this fact that the Prophet, we sent a Prophet who came to you enjoining to the goodness, forbidding evil, and prohibiting some specific impurities and making purities halal. Then Allah says, then he will remove the shackles and chains from you. Mm-hmm. He will give you freedom. So this is the function of religion. This is not about akhirah.
So this
is about the material life. The material life. In the material life, when you practice religion, at the beginning there must be some do's and don'ts. You just do not judge the religion by do's and don'ts to say that, you know, it's a burden. This is how, unfortunately, the problem is that they see it as a burden. But when you practice this do's and don'ts, Allah says the result is that you will have freedom. And this is what in politics they call it positive freedom versus negative freedom. Negative freedom is what liberalism, you know, promotes. Negative freedom means that there is no one with a stick to push you to do something. Mm. So you see that right now in the world, what the world that we are living in, people are forced to live a specific life, but there is no stick. The ladies should wear a specific makeup and a specific clothing, and the youth, you see that status symbol for the youth for some years, that they used to wear even today the ripped jeans with lots of holes on it. Mm. 20 years ago, it was crazy if you told people that you will pay money to wear jeans which is ripped. This is nonsense. But they make you. This is negative freedom. It means that nobody is there with a stick, but they brainwash you. Mm. But in Islam, the positive freedom is that from the very first day, they say, do this, don't do this. I'm limiting you. But this is freedom for. Means that there is a purpose behind these limitations. Mm. I have seen in different countries that I was there, I don't want to mention the names. You see, alcohol, for example, in Islam, alcohol is abandoned. So for many people, it might look difficult not to drink alcohol, not to drink wine. But when you look at the life, especially at the pandemic, which was there, the COVID, they banned, you know, selling alcohol. Mm-hmm. So it became a black market.
Oh, yeah.
Why? Because it is harmful. I had a friend in hospital, and he said that on the weekends, because at the weekends, people drink a lot. He said the great department in the hospital we are is dedicated to injured people. Mm. To dispatch the why? Because people come injured. The man is drunk and they break the bottle and they hurt the ladies, their own wives, the children, because the man is out of his mind. Lots of accidents happen on weekends because people are driving while they are drunk. Mm-hmm. So you see that even if they look at the damages that it has for the body, There was a kind of statistics why Muslims live longer life in Russia in comparison to Christians. One of the main elements is because Muslims do not drink. The Christians, they say that because Russia is very cold, we drink vodka, then it makes it hot. Mm. So it destroys them from inside. And Muslims have longer life in comparison. One of the elements is because they don't drink. So, I mean, even if you look at from the materialistic perspective, then you will see that this is the right thing. It's giving you freedom. So, I mean, the training should be there and people should learn. Then you will see that there is no conflict in practice. Of course, the temptations will be there. But by appealing to the rulings, then you will see that at the end, you will have the positive freedom, means the better life, the better lifestyle.
So, you mean paying attention to do's and don'ts, we gradually find our balance in life.
That's
our
true.
Life is
that's true. And that is the whole religion is. You see that always in all Salatul Jum'ah, the khutaba, those who are delivering the lecture, they refer to this hadith of Imam Ali salam, usikum bitaqwa Allah wa nazma amrikum. Actually, taqwa is to observe the do's and don'ts. And nazm that comes after taqwa is the social taqwa.
So
nazm, you can describe nazm as social taqwa.
So this order, this balance, this comes when there is some do's and don'ts. Yeah. And without them,
and give order
you can't
to the life.
Find balance. You can't find balance without them.
Yeah, that's the point.
It's meaningless.
That's the point.
Yeah. It's meaningless. Thank you. And let's go back to our brother Ali here in the office. Can you answer this question that some of our listeners may have? Islam was born, correct me if I'm wrong, 1,400 years ago. Does it fit in our society? Shouldn't it be updated? Or can it be updated on a daily basis?
Yeah. Yes, we have heard a lot of such sentences and the sentences alike. Like, for example, it might not have the same functionality that it had, for example, 1,400 years ago, and it's like addicting the nations and many other statements, but they need to be answered in this way that look, Islam, which we claim that is the most perfect religion among the religions and the last of the religions, has already actually provided all the needs for a perfect life. And the needs and requirements have been seen inside it. But due to the changes of the time and due to the requirements of the time and place, also Islam has its own, again, expediency inside it. That is, by power of inference or ijtihad inside it, even the problems of the day are being answered. I mean, there is no worry about this. Islam, which is being made of ahkam, decrees and laws, or let's say regulations, aqaid, beliefs and akhlaq, moralities. So there are a set of fixed principles inside the rules and regulations of Islam in these three branches. But due to the expediency and the needs and requirements of time and place, some changes can happen inside them. For example, but not in the fixed beliefs, I mean. In the beliefs, there is no change. Whatever has come, even the Imam and the Prophet cannot change the believing system that has been legislated by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right? So even those who are claiming such a thing, they are usually worried about the issues that they have in their daily lives. So as for those issues, Islam gave a power to the expert of Islam, to the Islamic authorities, by this tool, that is the tool of ijtihad or inference, to infer from the basis. We have certain bases. We have mabani, that is basis or principles, that through understanding them, this person who is an expert in Islamic laws and Islamic beliefs can understand, can legislate, can issue the verdict or decree which is needed for the same issue that the people are afflicted with. So there is no, I want to emphasize that there is no deadlock in Islamic beliefs and Islamic, in practicing Islamic laws and regulations. I mean, there is no issue that we face, for example, that, and Islam is silent in answering or in helping us
with
that issue.
Can I say it in this way? Can I say it in this way? Islam and its practices are an answer to the needs. And needs do not change over time. The needs are fixed.
Definitely. I mean, look, maybe the kind of
not
need
once,
that we have...
I mean, not once. Yeah.
Look, maybe some of the needs are quite new needs and we don't know how to tackle them. I mean, I want to say that even through the basics, through, I call them, primary laws, in comparison to the secondary laws, based on the understanding that this Islamic expert, who is known as Islamic authority, has gained by these primary laws, he can actually infer the answer for any kind of issues that happens to the people.
Yeah, you know, I'm just the thing I was trying to ask you was this: sometimes we have these needs. Sometimes we have these wants, So we can replace wants. For example, I want a sandwich. Okay, do you want something else? Maybe the sandwich is not good for me, or I can replace it with something else. So it changes over time.
True.
But the needs, when I'm thirsty, the only thing that can help me, that can satisfy me is water. I cannot replace it with soda or something else. So the thing I was asking you is this. Maybe the needs change, but the wants, is this, can you... Any thoughts?
As I said, for a human being, there are different kinds of issues. The issues that usually human beings are afflicted with are in two types. Either they are from primary ones, primary level, or the first, or the fixed levels, or the fixed or primary needs and requirements. Or second, the things that human beings usually have, and they change in the course of history, in the course of time. Like, for example, from the first level, let me give you an example from the primary ones. Mm. The belief in Allah, or the need for having, let's say, a believing system. Mm-hmm. Or the need to have some, let's say, access to the ahkam and akhlaq, or moralities, where some to some extent are fixed. As for moralities, when I'm saying that they are to some extent fixed, it depends. I mean, sometimes I want just to have a blank place for the issues that usually are controversial that I don't want to get into it. Like, for example, the lie. For example, lying is something forbidden, but to save the one's life, usually lying is not forbidden then, because you are going to save one's life. So in this issue that are controversial, I don't want to get into those issues as well. But some issues like, for example, the kind of vehicle that you use to go to your work. Sometimes it is a bicycle, later on it becomes a car. I don't know, in future it might become an airplane or something else. So they are different. I mean, these secondary kinds of needs, the issues that are related to such secondary levels can be answered very easily through the tool of ijtihad, and it is quite open, and so the hands of the expert is open in answering.
Yeah, so you believe that by ijtihad we have this system to update. Islam has this system to update itself, and this is
actually Islam is not being updated, because Islam is there, but through the basics we can understand and we can infer for any kind of issue that we have at our time.
So,
because Islam has revealed and has sent them and has been introduced
so
by the Holy Prophet
these days. Yeah, don't you think so? That's why it's so alive these days. If this is the only reason we can find.
Due to the nature of Islam, which has already thought about all the needs and requirements of human, and that is the ability that gave it to the expert of the religion and even to the Imam and the Prophet. We see, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in one time he gives priority to giving, for example, to pay khums, right, for the horses, while it was not the concept of khums was not going to be taken from the horses, but so due to the power that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives to this person who is implementer of religion. So his hands are open to interpret and to do what
so
is needful.
So you mean the Islam, the practices, the belief system, and the things that support it is, in a way, it's like it
it's
gives us
always
some,
alive, and
yeah,
there is no deadlock in its teachings and in
some mechanism that makes it to be alive on a daily basis, and day by day it's going to be richer and it's rich. It's going to stay alive and change form through time. Yeah?
We can say that. I mean, it's better, yeah. I think, interpretation. Yeah. It's a better word to say that. Some of the forms are in the way that are needed for the society that we are living at.
Okay, very good. Well done. Well said. Thank you. And this is it. Today we talked about this worldly life and having a religious lifestyle, or I should say worldview. And we discussed some of the issues along with our team of experts. Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, our dear listeners. May the Mighty bless you all.
night you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, except Al-Habib. Ummati, يقولها لنا يوم القيامة. أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. The EU is a direct partner in the Zionist regime genocide in Gaza, and this is not a simple case of Western double standards. The Zionist regime sees Europe as a lackey, though Europe collectively carries significant economic weight. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Europe stayed silent when the Zionist regime began pounding the besieged Gaza Strip with a kind of ferocity that could only lead to a genocide. In fact, Europe remained silent when the word genocide quickly replaced the earlier reference to the Israeli-Hamas war starting on October 7th. Those familiar with Europe's political discourse and action regarding the Zionist regime and Palestine must already realize that most European governments have always been on the side of the fabricated regime of Israel. However, if this is entirely true, what can we make of the latest comments by the foreign policy chief of the European Union, Josep Borrell, when he seemed to lash out at Israel on January 23rd, accusing it of ceding aid for generations? During a joint press conference in Brussels with Egypt's foreign minister, Sameh Shoukry, and EU Commissioner for Enlargement, Oliver Varley, Borrell said that Israel cannot have the veto right to the self-determination of the Palestinian people. Borrell's frustration with Tel Aviv stems from the realization that Israel does not take Europe seriously. He's right. Tel Aviv regime never truly saw Brussels as a strong and relevant political actor in comparison to Washington or even London. Recent months have further exposed this unequal relationship. Soon after the Al-Aqsa flood operation, European leaders, starting with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, and French President Emmanuel Macron, flocked to Tel Aviv too, in the words of Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, reiterate that Israel has every right to defend itself. But European support exceeded that of language or political gestures. It also arrived in the form of military and intelligence support. Reuters reported, comparing the large sum to the 32 million euros worth of defense exports that were approved by Berlin in all of 2022, as of November 2nd, the German government has approved the export of close to 303 million euros worth of defense equipment to Israel. This is just one example. While the Americans did not shy away from assuming the role of partner in the Gaza genocide, the EU's position seemed dishonest and, at best, morally inconsistent. Borrell initially approached the genocidal war from an entirely pro-Israeli perspective. He said, when asked in an interview last November whether Israel is committing war crimes in Gaza, "I am not a lawyer." A minute later, he asserted that Hamas Al-Aqsa flood operation was undoubtedly a war crime. "This is not a simple case of Western double standards. The Zionist regime sees Europe as a lackey, though Europe collectively carries significant economic weight, which only in the case of the Zionist regime it refuses to translate into political leverage. Until Brussels learns to resolve this dichotomy, it will continue with this kind of bizarre foreign policy." One reason why the Zionist regime sees Europe as an inferior political actor compared to Washington is because the Europeans have linked much of their foreign policy agenda to the US, which in turn is motivated by Tel Aviv regime's agenda and interest. This is how it works. When Macron joined Biden in unconditionally supporting the Zionist regime in the beginning of the war, Netanyahu remarked that he was highly appreciative of the French position. But when, on November 11th, Macron dared criticize Israel's killing of women and babies in Gaza, Netanyahu immediately lashed out, accusing Macron of making a serious mistake, factually and morally. Slowly, Europe began developing a somewhat stronger position on Gaza, though certainly not strong enough to demand an end to the war or threaten consequences if the war does not end. On January 22nd, the EU held a ministerial meeting inviting the Zionist regime's foreign minister, Israel Katz, and Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyaz al-Maliki to attend. The conference was a feeble European attempt to signal the EU's readiness to assert itself as a relevant political actor in the West Asia region. The truth, however, is that the EU was motivated by other factors, including a green light from the Biden administration, which, as of late, has grown more frustrated with Netanyahu for refusing to engage in Washington's discourse about future visions and the two-state solution. Also, the regional instability, whether in the Red Sea or in Lebanon itself, a result of the war, continues to pose a direct risk to Europe's economic and strategic interest in the region. Europe's relationship with the West Asia region is in some ways different to that of Washington. While the U.S. is always ready to reinvest its geopolitical priorities, Europe is indefinitely bound by the rules of physical proximity to the West Asia region, its vital geography, its resources, and its people. Europe knows this. Borrell, who devised the maxim that Europe is a garden, the rest of the world is a jungle, and the jungle could invade the garden, also understands that the instability in the West Asia region could endanger his precious garden if even the war is over. This is why Borrell was keen on the EU's ministerial meeting, but instead of engaging in serious talks, the meeting further highlighted Europe's irrelevance, at least in the eyes of the Zionist regime. Katz had come to the meeting to present plans for an artificial island off the coast of Gaza, likely to displace Palestinians from the Strip, concepts that had nothing to do with the peace talks, Borrell said. Other top EU diplomats said the videos were part of old ideas presented by Katz in a previous role that they surprised everyone in the room. But the EU diplomats should not be surprised. After all, their governments are the ones who have empowered the child killer regime of Israel and disempowered Palestinians over 75 years. Even now, many of them continue to champion Israel's mass killings in Gaza as Tel Aviv regime's right to self-defense. If Borrell truly wishes to develop the political backbone, he should fully back international law and advocate for the use of the EU's massive economic leverage to put pressure on the child killer regime of Israel to end its war and military occupation of Palestine. Failing to do so gives great credibility to the claim that Brussels, just like Washington, is a direct partner in the Zionist regime's war on the Palestinian people.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel continues to target hospitals throughout the Gaza Strip.